chapter 2 tonight. And I want to talk about this topic, the world is not enough. Ecclesiastes chapter 2, and I want to read a few verses with you. Look at verse number 9, and we'll read down to verse 11 together. So I was great and increased more than all that were before me in Jerusalem. Also, my wisdom remained with me, and whatsoever mine eyes desired, I kept not from them. I withheld not my heart from any joy, for my heart rejoiced in all my labor. And this was my portion of all my labor. Then I looked on all the works that my hands had wrought, and on the labor that I had labored to do. And behold, all was vanity and vexation of spirit, and there was no profit under the sun. Harold Kushner, in his book, When All You've Ever Wanted Isn't Enough, it's the title of the book. He writes about a woman who married a successful corporate executive, and he bought her the dream house that she wanted in the suburbs. But in her book, or in this book, the story of this woman is about how this woman goes around the house saying every morning to herself, is this all there is to life? Is this all there is? She got what she wanted, but yet it didn't seem to be enough. What do you do when you have enough, you have everything you thought you ever wanted, and yet it still isn't enough? The quarterback for the New England Patriots, Tom Brady, was asked this very question on 60 Minutes. Tom Brady had just quarterbacked the Patriots to their third Super Bowl win. And what he said was, why do I have three Super Bowl rings and still think there is something else for me? He goes on to say, I think there's got to be more to it than this. I mean, this is not all it's cracked up to be. And then the interviewer asked a follow-up question, what is the answer? And Brady could only say, I wish I knew. I wish I knew. Well, in Ecclesiastes, Solomon is reporting to us the results of a quest that he had to find the meaning of life. And he's seeking the answer to that question, is there more to life than this? Is there anything more than just what we have here? Now, first he tried to answer this question by using all the facilities of his mind. And he tried to figure out all the mysteries of existence. He tried to find the answer by using human wisdom, and we found last time that human wisdom does not answer the question. In fact, he ended up depressed and filled with sorrow. He called it chasing the wind. Now, at this point, most people would give up and cave into depression, yet Solomon did not. He tries another approach. In fact, in chapter 2, verse 1, he begins to talk to himself. He says to himself in his own heart, go to now. Now, he's not gone crazy or insane. He determines to experiment even more. He's going to try harder. He's like a scientist in the laboratory of life, and he's not going to just give up after one experiment. So he says in verse 1, I said in mine heart, go to now, I will prove thee with mirth, therefore enjoy pleasure. So what does he do? He says, I'm going to try pleasure. I want you to look at verse 1. Every word in this phrase is important. Prove, or in verse 1, is nasa, to put to the test. It's the idea of an experiment, a deliberate attempt to learn something from personal experience. Solomon is saying, I'm going to try to learn something from my own experience. Look at the word pleasure. He wants to experience pleasure. That is his whole experiment now. It's like the song that was written, The Wanderer, based on Ecclesiastes chapter 2. I went out there in search of experience to taste and to touch and to feel as much as a man can before he repents. That's exactly Solomon's attitude here. And notice the word I. I said in mine heart. Now what you're going to notice in chapter 2, there's so much I or me or mine or myself in this whole chapter. We kind of get the strong sense of self-indulgence at the pursuit of self-centered pleasure. And one, we could really summarize all of this in one word, and that's hedonism. And that's the idea of the pursuit of pleasure. Hedonism comes from the Greek word hedon, and it just means pleasure. And it's the person who is seeking for happiness, seeking for pleasure. That's all their life really boils down to make me happy, to go after every pleasure that there is. And Solomon says, this is what I'm going to try now. I'm going to experiment with pleasure. I'm going to try out everything that the world has to offer and see if there's any answers in that and see if I can find fulfillment in that and meaning in that. But we don't really have to wait till the end to find the answer, because he tells us in the end of verse 1, look what he says. And behold, this is also what? Vanity, the word that he uses. He tells us right up front. He doesn't keep us in suspense. Pleasure did not satisfy his soul any more than wisdom did. Behold is a word that he uses to demand our attention. In a sense, Solomon is saying, look, you don't have to go out there and experiment with the world, because I already did, and I want you to know that it doesn't give anything. It doesn't profit at all. It's all vanity. It's all vapor and smoke and meaninglessness. Pleasure may seem to hold the promise of purpose in life, but take it from me, Solomon says, it doesn't. So with all that in mind, I want you to see the three stages in his experiment here in chapter 2. If you're taking notes, write down number 1, the desire for the world. The desire for the world. Solomon is going to go after the world in his experiment. Where it says, go to now. We could say it like this. Away we go. Here we go. This is his journal of what he went after. This is what he tried. And notice, first of all, he tries laughter in verse 2. I said of laughter, it is mad, and of mirth, what doeth it? First, he tries to experiment with comedy and laughter. Many people kind of use comedy to make it through life. It kind of is an escape for some people during the hard times. When they feel insecure, they make a joke. Or when they feel down, they want to hear a comedian. People just want to laugh today. If you don't believe me, the richest people in the world today are comedians. If you have the gift of making an audience laugh, you can make millions of dollars. And the famous or the popular TV shows are the sitcoms. Now, there's nothing wrong with laughter. I love to laugh. But in the end, Solomon says, he asks the question, what doeth it? What does it do? Now, laughter is a gift from God when it's used properly. And again, there's nothing wrong with good, wholesome, hearty laughter. But Solomon said in the end, it doesn't really offer any solutions. It doesn't tell us anything about the purpose of life. In fact, he said, I said of laughter, it is mad. What does he mean by mad? It doesn't mean to be insane. It means moral perversity is the idea. In fact, what he's saying is a lot of laughter that the world is giving is not an expression of good, wholesome fun. A lot of it reveals the perversity of this world. There's a lot of comedy out there that's really perverse. There's a lot of things being said out there that people laugh at that reveal the madness of the human race, the madness of this world, the perversion of this world. Show me what you laugh at and I'll show you what kind of person that you are. But of course, not all laughter is bad. A lot of it, I said, is good. It's a gift from God. But Solomon had to come to the conclusion that it doesn't offer any solutions. Here's how T.M. Moore paraphrases it. He said, I concluded that laughter and merriment for their own sakes were madness. What did they accomplish to help me find lasting meaning and purpose in life? In the end, Solomon says, life is no laughing matter. But then he tries another thing. He tries liquor. Look in verse 2, or verse 3 rather. I sought in my heart to give myself unto wine, yet acquainting my heart with wisdom, to lay hold on folly till I might see that was, what was that good, for the sons of men, which they should do under the heaven all the days of their life. Solomon said in this verse, he's going to try out wine or liquor, but he's not going to go overboard. He's going to be very careful. He's going to acquaint his heart with wisdom at the same time. In other words, he wants to try out wine, but he wants to keep his wits about him. He doesn't want to become a drunkard. He wants to rationally indulge in this area to see if it offers any answers. And yet we're going to find that he's unable to do that. And by the way, that's a delusion, a lie, to be able to social drink. Let me tell you, one out of every three social drinkers becomes a drunkard. Alcohol is nothing more than the devil in liquid form. It's America's greatest drug abuse. And later Solomon will write this in Proverbs, wine is a mocker, strong drink is raging, whoever is deceived thereby is not wise. There's no answers in that. It doesn't help. It only makes things worse. Solomon went after it with all the gusto he could. Like the commercial many years ago, you only go around once, so grab all the gusto you can. Solomon did that, but he found out that there's nothing in that. And in verse the second part of verse 3, where he says, I might see what was that good for the sons of men, which they should do under the heaven all the days of their life. There's kind of a veiled reference to impending death in that phrase. He wanted to find out if drinking and drinking parties were the best solution to the emptiness of life in the face of death. But again, alcohol offers nothing. And so he moves on. He tries labor. He tried laughter, liquor, but now labor. Look at verse number 4. I made me great works. I built me houses. I planted me vineyards. I made me gardens and orchards, and I planted trees in them of all kinds of fruits. I made me pools of water to water therewith the wood that bringeth forth trees. So here Solomon gets involved in all kind of building projects. He becomes an architect, a developer, a builder. And by the way, these were not public buildings, because notice the phrase, I made me. This was all for me. This is not public buildings for the benefit of others. Solomon said, this is all me. This is all my palace, all my paradise. I built me houses and gardens. These were mansions for my own pleasure. If you look in 1 Kings chapter 7, verses 1 to 12, Solomon built his royal palace at great expense. You know how long it took him to build his palace? 10 years. Didn't take him that long to build the temple. But in his own palace, it took him 10 years. He also planted magnificent gardens. In verse number 5, I made me gardens and orchards. Great gardens were the pride of ancient kings, as is indicated by the hanging gardens of Babylon. In verse 6, lush vegetation he planted was irrigated by waters, reservoirs. In verse 6, I made me pools of water to water wherewith the wood that bringeth forth trees. And so he creates his own little Garden of Eden. In fact, Derek Kidner wrote, he creates a little world within a world, a secular Garden of Eden with no forbidden fruits. His palace was paradise regained. If Solomon were living today, he would be on the front of Better Homes and Gardens and living in luxury. And yet, there really isn't any fulfillment in that. So he goes on. He tries luxury, not only labor, but luxury. Look in verse 7. He lists all the things that he has. I got me servants and maidens and had servants born in my house. Also, I had great possessions of great and small cattle above all that were in Jerusalem before me. In verse 8, I gathered me also silver and gold and the peculiar treasure of kings and the provinces. I got me men singers and women singers and the delights of the sons of men as musical instruments and that of all sorts. And so I was great and increased more than all that were before me in Jerusalem. So he begins to list all of his possessions. And let me tell you, he had a lot. He talks about his manual labors. And by the way, given the size of his palace and gardens, he needed a huge workforce to keep up the daily operation. So he purchases slaves. And those slaves have children in his house, and they belong to him. And to feed them all, he had to have huge flocks and herds of cattle. And he had them all over. Back in this day, wealth was measured by flocks and herds. In 1 Kings 10, verses 4 to 8, it reveals that Solomon had countless servants waiting on him hand and foot. In fact, the queen of Sheba marveled at the number of his servants. In 1 Kings 4:23, he had so many animals that every day the chefs in his royal kitchen would have to prepare this, quote, 10 fat oxen, 20 pasture-fed cattle, 100 sheep, besides deer, gazelles, roebucks, and fattened fowl. That's a lot of food to prepare, a lot of meat. And they had to do this daily. But not only that, his money. He says he has a lot of money. In verse 8, I gathered me also silver and gold. And he had all this in great abundance. Again, if you look in 1 Kings 10, we find that the weight of the gold that came to Solomon yearly was 666 talents of gold. In current dollars today, that would be about $500 million. I mean, that's pretty good. Besides that, he had other gifts that were given, other taxes that were levied upon people. Money was coming in that way. And so he was literally, by our standards today, he was a billionaire. It is said that the plates that he ate from were gold. His bodyguards had shields of gold. He himself sat on an ivory throne overlaid with gold. Someone wrote that he sent his navies to distant lands to bring in precious metals and precious stones. And so he had it all. But then also notice his music. He had enough to hire singers in verse 8. I got me men singers and women singers. And music in this day was something that most people could not have. But he had the money to hire musicians and choirs to sing for his pleasure. He had it all. But then look at the end of verse 8. There's a phrase there that's interesting where it says, and the delights of the sons of men. Now, most scholars agree that he's referring here to his concubines. Solomon had a huge harem. According to 1 Kings 11:3, they numbered 1,300 wives, 700 concubines. Solomon was a playboy. He was the Hugh Hefner of his day. One commentator wrote this: the erotic luxury of his vast harem was the royal icing on his cake of pleasure. So in summary, Solomon went after everything, all that the world could offer, all the pleasures that the world would give. And he had it all. He got it all. And in fact, did you notice that everything is in the plural in chapter 2? It's not singular or plural. He didn't have a house. He had houses. Not a garden, but gardens. Not a pool, but pools. He had it in the plural. He had an abundance of everything. And it all is summarized in verse 9. Look at it. So I was great and increased more than all that were before me in Jerusalem, and also my wisdom remained with me. And whatsoever mine eyes desired, I kept not from them. And I withheld not any my heart from any joy, for my heart rejoiced in all my labor, and this was my portion in all my labor. There he sums it up. He said, I got whatever I wanted. In fact, what we see in verses 9 and 10 is what I think is the most biblical definition of the world. Because what is the world in 1 John? 1 John says, for all that is in the world is the lust of the flesh and the lust of the eyes and the pride of life. That's the world. If you had enough money that you could get anything that you saw with your eyes, anything you saw, you wanted to get it, you had enough money, you could purchase it just like that, you would have a third of the world. But anything your heart desired you could get, that's another third of the world. Or any achievement or objective that you set out to do, you were able to do it. That's the pride of life. That's another third of the world. Solomon had all of that. Again, in verse 9, where he says, I was great and increased more than all that were all before me in Jerusalem. That's the pride of life, right? Verse 10, whatsoever mine eyes desired, I kept not from them. Whatever I saw, Solomon said, I wanted it, I got it. That's the lust of the eyes. And then in verse 10, I withheld not my heart from any joy. That's the lust of the flesh. Whatever his flesh desired, he got it. He had it all. He had the world. Wine, women, and song. It was all his. Again, if you were living today, he would be on Fortune magazine. Now, we would say, boy, it's hard not to envy a guy like this. I mean, wouldn't you like to live like a king? Wouldn't you like to have a nicer house? Beautiful pools and gardens? Wouldn't you like to have servants waiting on you hand and foot? Wouldn't you like to have millions of dollars? So what is the result of all this? What is the result of a man who had it all, who pursued all that the world had and was able to attain it? He was fulfilled, right? He was satisfied. He was happy, right? Happiest man on earth? Well, this leads to point number 2. We see the desire for the world. Solomon went after it all. But number 2, write down the disappointment in the world. Because look, it really is summarized. Look at verse 17, because it really summarizes his whole heart. In verse 17 of chapter 2, notice what he says. Therefore, I hated life, because the work that is wrought under the sun is grievous to me. It is all vanity and vexation of spirit. Solomon said, I hated life. Wow. He was disgusted with it all. None of it brought fulfillment. And so he's learning a hard lesson here. In fact, he's learning a lesson that many people are learning today. And that is, the world is not enough. It can't fulfill. It can't satisfy. The answer is not in hedonism. It's not in pleasure seeking. Solomon was totally disappointed in the world. And he was disappointed for several reasons. Look at the first one. First of all, write down, you can't find satisfaction in it. That's the first reason he was disappointed. Look in verse number 11 of chapter 2. Then I looked on all the works that my hands had wrought, and all the labor that I had labored to do, and behold, all was vanity and vexation of spirit, and there was no profit under the sun. The word looked, panna, to look at something square in the eye, square in the face. Solomon is facing up to the situation. He's looking at the whole situation squarely, and he's coming to a conclusion. And you know what the conclusion is? The world just doesn't satisfy. Seeking pleasure doesn't cut it. It's all vanity and vexation of spirit. Despite all of his accomplishments, all of his possessions, he was hollow. It left him without any sense of permanent happiness. And in verse 11, the latter phrase, he says, there was no profit under the sun. Now, again, many people today are experiencing the same thing as Solomon in Ecclesiastes. They're finding out that what he said was absolutely true. Many are discovering that the world indeed cannot satisfy. It's not enough. We live in a very materialistic and rich culture today, if we would admit it. And in fact, I think if Solomon were alive today, he would envy us, because we have a lot of things he did not have. We live today in homes that are really, in a lot of ways, better than the home that he lived in. Solomon never had air conditioning and heating in his house, or running water like we have today. We have better furniture than he had. We have climate control. We have better food. When we go to the grocery store, you can buy anything you want from places all over the world. Walk into Sam's Club if you don't believe me. Look at all the stuff that's there for people to get. We listen to music. We don't have to hire singers or choirs today. We have an iPad, or we have an iPod, or we have iTunes. We can listen to whatever music we want. We can download it immediately. Music from all over the world, from every musician in the world. It's right at our fingertips. Solomon never had that. We can indulge in every selfish indulgence that can ever be thought of today. We have it all. So are people happy today? Are they satisfied? Are they fulfilled today? Well, let me give you an answer given by Greg Easterbrook. He gives his answer in the book, The Progress of Paradox, a book which is subtitled, How Life Gets Better While People Feel Worse. And in this book, Easterbrook basically proves that we have almost anything or everything we want today. We have it all except happiness. There's no happiness. In fact, he writes in the book, this is his whole theme and motif of the book, the more that we have, the more unhappier we are. That's what he goes to prove. And you know what? He proves it very well. And Solomon reaches the same conclusion. The more things that he had, the more dissatisfied he became. The more unhappier he was. I was reading this week, do you know which nation is categorized as the happiest nation or has the happiest citizens in it? In fact, a survey was done. According to a CNN report, this is an analysis of more than 65 countries by the World Values Survey, which suggests a happiness index. And they use all these factors to determine where the happiest place is in the world. Which country is the happiest in the world? And looking at this survey, you would think, well, the U.S. has got to be number one on that. I mean, we've got everything here. We've got all the technology. We've got all the luxury. We're the richest nation in the world. But according to this survey, the happiest country in the world is in Africa, a country, Nigeria. And then Mexico follows on that, then Venezuela, then El Salvador, then Puerto Rico. You say, where does the United States come in this survey? It comes in 16th. 16th. Australia, 20th. Great Britain, 24th. That's what I kind of call my daughter Abby and get her back over here. She's in Great Britain. This survey is conducted every 4 years by an international network of social scientists, and it shows that happiness has very little to do with your wealth or your income. Very little to do. In fact, the researchers included this sentence in their report. Let me quote to you what they're saying in the report. Survey after survey has shown that the desire for material goods, which has increased hand in hand with average income, is a happiness suppressant. Did you get that? A happiness suppressant. The more material goods we have, the more unhappier we are, is what they're saying. In other words, the more we have what we want, the more we want what we don't have. And so it has nothing to do with material possessions. So pursuing these things in and of themselves does not satisfy. Now, someone may be sitting here and thinking, well, perhaps there was something that Solomon didn't try. Perhaps there was something he missed out on. I mean, he couldn't have covered all the bases, could he? Well, look in verse number 12, because he answers that. And I turned myself to behold wisdom and madness and folly, for what can the man do that cometh after the king? Even that which has been already done. Solomon says, look, no one can come after me and try something that I haven't already done. You can't do it. Just in case you might think it will be different for you, Solomon says it won't. He was the ultimate test case. He had the ability to try it all, and he did. And he left no stone unturned. So you can't find satisfaction in it. That's his disappointment. And then you can't keep it. Look at verse number 13. Then I saw that wisdom excelleth folly, as far as the light excelleth darkness. The wise man's eyes are in his head, but the fool walketh in darkness. And I myself perceive also that one event happens to them all. Then said I in my heart, as it happened to the fool, so it happened even to me. And why was I then more wise? And then I said in my heart that this is also vanity. So what's he saying here? Notice where he says that one event happens to them all. And here the point is that death will cause you to leave everything behind. All of your degrees and all of your dollars will be left behind when death comes. Death is the great leveler. Doesn't matter whether you're smart, you're a wise man, or you're a fool, whether you're rich or you're poor, death levels it all out, and we're all the same at death. It will reduce everyone to the same exact level. Because you can't take any of it, you can't keep it and take it with you. Alexander the Great learned this lesson that death is a leveler. He learned it from his friend in a dramatic way. His friend was named Diogenes. He was a famous philosopher. Alexander the Great found Diogenes standing in a field looking over bones. And Alexander the Great said, "What are you doing?" And he answered and said, "I'm looking for the bones of your father Philip, but I cannot seem to distinguish them from the bones of slaves." He got the point. At the end, in death, we're all the same. It's a great leveler. It's a leveler of all men. So you can't keep it, but then there's another disappointing conclusion. You can't protect it. Look at verse number 18. "Yea, I hated all my labor which I had taken under the sun, because I should leave it unto the man that should be after me. And who knoweth whether he shall be a wise man or a fool? Yet shall he have rule over all my labor wherein I have labored, and wherein I have showed myself wise under the sun. This also is vanity." Solomon is saying, after all the work that I've done, all the material possessions I collect, what's going to happen at death is I'm going to leave it all behind to someone else. Someone else is going to come along and take it. And he didn't have to labor for it like I did. He'll just walk into it. And who knows whether this person is going to be a wise person or a fool. He could come in and take all the possessions, all of the things that I've earned, and he could just foolishly spend it away. And so I can't protect what I've received. Of course, you know, it's okay to leave an inheritance to your children. That is, if the government doesn't get it or a crafty lawyer steal it away. It's okay to leave things to your children. But it's dangerous to leave them too much, Solomon is saying. It may destroy them. We've heard of this happening in a lot of families where a rich man left it all to a son who didn't have enough wisdom to really use it wisely. And it just about destroyed him. But the point is, the accumulation of worldly wealth does not produce anything that endures through eternity. Because you can't protect it. You can't reach back from the grave and control things once you're gone. Who knows what's going to happen to all of that wealth? Well, then there's another disappointing conclusion. Solomon says you can't find satisfaction in it. You can't keep it. You can't protect it. And you really can't enjoy it. Look at verse 21. "For there is a man whose labor is in wisdom and in knowledge and in equity, yet to a man that hath not labored therein he shall leave it for his portion. This is also vanity and a great evil." Verse 22. "For what hath man of all his labor and of the vexation of his heart wherein he hath labored under the sun? For all his days are sorrows and his travail grief. Yea, his heart taketh not rest in the night. This also is vanity." You say, what's Solomon saying here? The point is that for all the strain that it took to get you all these worldly possessions, you really can't enjoy them. What he's saying is, in the acquisition of these things and laboring and travailing to get all these things and all the dreaming and scheming it took to gather them all together, you had no joy in that. And then after you got it together, you couldn't enjoy it. You couldn't sleep at night afterward because you were worried over the fact that you might lose them, all this riches that you had. In other words, what he's saying is the stress and the strain and attaining all of this wealth, which was the whole goal of life, is to get all that you can. The stress and the strain does not equal out to the enjoyment. We would say it like this: the enjoyment doesn't justify the employment. What it took to get it doesn't really justify the little bit of joy that I get in it. It's just not worth it. Not worth going after all that, for all the strain that it produces. And now it gives me sleepless nights. I read one time where John D. Rockefeller worried about his money so much that it caused bad health and he couldn't eat. He had to eat crackers and drink milk because he had a bad stomach, because he was always worried about someone stealing away his wealth. He had all this money, but he couldn't enjoy it. And that's what Solomon is saying here. You can't enjoy it. And so all of this leads to disappointment. It's not worth it, he says. This leads to the third major point: the desire for the world, the disappointment of the world. But here's the third thing: the deduction about the world. And this leads to this one conclusion. Look in verse number 24. This is what he says. These, to me, are the most powerful verses in the whole chapter. So look at them carefully. There is nothing better for a man than that he should eat and drink, that he should make his soul enjoy good in all his labor. This also I saw, that it was from the hand of God. For who can eat, or who else can hasten hereunto more than I? For God giveth to a man that is good in his sight, wisdom and knowledge and joy. But to the sinner he giveth travail to gather and to heap up, that he may give to him that is good before God. This also is vanity and vexation of spirit. You say, what's Solomon concluding from his experiment? What does he deduce from grasping the world? And by the way, this is the first time in these verses we see Solomon ever mentioning God. First time in the whole book. And he mentions God three times. And actually, these verses mark a turning point in the book of Ecclesiastes. These are profound verses, because now Solomon points to God and he points to the realm of faith. He points above the sun, whereas he was looking at everything under the sun. Now, for the first time, he looks over the sun and he points to God. Martin Luther called the end of Ecclesiastes 2 a remarkable passage, one that explains everything preceding and following it. And when you say, what's the conclusion? Well, he already stated it at the very beginning, and that is, the world cannot satisfy. It's not enough to fulfill the heart. Listen, contentment and fulfillment and satisfaction is something that comes from God. It's a gift from Him, and it comes from knowing Him. It comes from knowing God and realizing that everything you have, He is the one that has given these things to you as gifts from Him to you. That's the way you view it. You see, when the world becomes a substitute for God, the things of this world are a curse. And the world seeks to do that. The world seeks to substitute itself for God. And when a person seeks after the world and the things of the world instead of God, then it leaves them empty. It leaves them dissatisfied. It leaves them miserable. It'll do it every time. When the world and the things of the world becomes that person's source of happiness, it leads to sorrow. It leads to emptiness. That's what John meant in 1 John chapter 2, verse 15. Love not the world, neither the things that are in the world. If any man love the world, what? The love of the Father is not in him. If you love the things of this world, and if the world is your source of happiness, that means you don't have the love of God in you. That's not the way to happiness. But the things of this world as a gift from God, now that's different. You see, man was created to enjoy God. Man was created to fellowship with God. And when you come to know God and love God supremely, and God is your source of happiness, that's where joy comes from. That's where fulfillment and contentment comes from. And therefore, all the things that are given to us in this life, we look at them as expressions of love from our supreme creator, our God, to us. We don't hold on to these things. We just look at these things as an expression of love to God. And we can worship God by enjoying the gifts that He gives us. That's what Solomon is saying. Look at verse 25. For who can eat, or who else can hasten hereunto more than I? And I think the translation of this here in the King James is a little bit awkward. We could say it like this. For who can eat and who can have enjoyment without Him? That's the point. How can you enjoy anything without Him? When God is the supreme love of your life, He's the center of your life, then we can enjoy His gifts. But we enjoy the giver more than the gifts themselves. We enjoy what He has done for us. And we realize that all that I have and all that I am is because of God and what He has done for me. God's given me a precious wife. He's given me wonderful children. He's given me a home and car. He's given me clothes. He's given me everything that I could ever want. And everything that He gives me is another expression of His grace and love to me. And by enjoying these things that He's giving me, I'm worshiping the God who gave it to me. You know what that's called? That's called Christian hedonism. Enjoying the things that God has given and worshiping the giver of them. I'm not captivated with these things. These things don't draw me away, but these things do show me the love of my Father. You see, and if God chooses to take those things away, that's okay, because He's such a gracious giver, He's going to give more. He'll give me back other things. You see, and this is Solomon's whole point. Paul wrote it like this. Listen, 1 Timothy 6:17, charge them that are rich in this world that they be not high-minded, nor trust in uncertain riches. But watch this, but in the living God. Paul said, look, if you have a lot in this world, you better be careful that you don't put your trust in those riches. But you trust in the living God. And listen, he goes on to say, the living God who gives us richly all things to enjoy. He gives us these things that we might enjoy them. But friend, when we substitute these things for God, they become a curse. And there's no joy in that. There's no satisfaction in that. Jonathan Edwards, when he pastored his first church, pastored a splinter group. A church had split. It was actually a splinter, just a handful of people that split away from a church that met in New York City on Broad and Wall Street. And all he was hired to do is just preach sermons to them. And he did such a good job of preaching to them that they decided to repent, get right with God, and go back to the church and reunite with the church. So he literally preached himself out of a job. But in that time of his ministry, he preached a sermon that has since become a famous sermon. It was called The Pleasantness of Religion. And this was actually an evangelistic sermon. And Edwards develops what some have called the pleasure argument. And this is what he says. In order to invite people to come to Christ, he says, you ought to come to Christ just for the sheer pleasure of being a Christian. That was his whole point. He wasn't talking about the pleasure in the life to come. He was talking about the pleasure of things right now. The sheer joy that comes with being a Christian. And in his sermon, he basically said that when you get saved and you come to know God, you now have the ability to really enjoy the gifts that He gives. Whereas before, you couldn't enjoy them. Before, there was always this thing of conscience. Before, the world would slavishly partake in the things of this world, trying to capture those things and bring them into their own heart to love those things. Now that you're a Christian, you can enjoy these things peaceably. And by doing so, you can enjoy the Lord. You can enjoy God. He goes on to say in the sermon, let me give you a quote. Religion, we could say Christianity, allows us to take the full comfort of our meat and drink, all reasonable pleasures that are to be enjoyed in our life and recreation. It allows the gratification of all our natural appetites. And there are none of the five senses but what we are allowed to please and gratify. In other words, he's saying now you have the full ability to fully enjoy all these gifts that God has given you, because now God is supreme in your life and He's number one. The pleasantness of religion. We can enjoy these things more than anyone else because we know that God is our supreme joy. He is first place in our life. And this is exactly what Solomon is talking about. And so you have a decision to make, the world or God. What do you want to go after? You want the world or do you want God? If you choose God, God rewards you with all kind of joy and pleasure in this life. Someone says, well, what if I choose the world? Well, the last verse tells us what to expect from that. And we'll close with this. Look in verse 26. Look at the latter phrase. Well, actually, just look at the whole verse. For God giveth to man that is good in his sight, wisdom and knowledge and joy. When we choose God, he gives us all these good things, wisdom, knowledge, true joy. But on the other hand, but to the sinner, that is the person who doesn't choose God, he giveth travail to gather and to heap up, that he may give to him that is good before God. This also is vanity and vexation of spirit. Solomon basically is telling us, and by the way, this is the first time he mentions sin or sinner. He's saying to the person who chooses the world, who forgets God, his life will be dominated by gathering, by heaping up, that is, by going after things, the acquisition, the accumulation of all the things of this world. His life will be given to that, but sooner or later, he's going to have to leave them all behind. And you know what God will do? God will take what he has heaped up and he will give it to those people that please him. That's what Solomon is saying. He's going to give it to those that is good before God. It's like the Canaanites who lost their city to the Israelites. God took it all away, gave it to Israel. It's like Haman who had to dress his mortal enemy Mordecai in royal robes. Like Nabal who had to give all his riches to David after he died. God is saying, go ahead and live for the things of this world, but it's all going to be travail. You can heap it up. You can gather it all together. But one day it's all going to be taken from you and I will distribute it to those who please me. That will be your end. And that's it. Friend, I don't know about you, but you can take the world. Give me Jesus. Give me Christ. Give me God. That's where true joy and contentment and satisfaction come from. Let's bow together for prayer tonight. So, Father, we thank you again for this reminder from Solomon, the man who went after it all and who received it all, but there was no joy. And now he leaves us this lesson for us to learn. We don't have to go through the experiments that he went through. We have this book to read. And we're reminded once again, Father, that we can enjoy nothing truly without you. We can find no true satisfaction and purpose and meaning without you. So, Father, help us to keep our eyes focused on Christ. Help us, Lord, to look to you, to love you supremely, and to realize that there's nothing that can rival you in this world, nothing even close. So with heads bowed and eyes closed, I just want to ask you tonight, where is your heart in all this? It may be that here lately and you've taken your eyes off of the Lord and you've put your eyes on the world and the things of the world. And you're cold and you're empty. You see, this can happen to a believer, not just an unbeliever. It's very possible for a person to get saved, find their joy and fulfillment in God and forget that the world can offer nothing. And they get their eyes off the Lord and they begin to go after things again. And that emptiness, that hollowness returns. You know why? Because you were created to enjoy God and the fellowship with Him. So I want to ask you tonight, where are you in that? Are you truly in fellowship with God? Are you truly enjoying His presence in your life? His fellowship. Is He the joy of your heart? Or have you begun to replace Him with things? Friend, if that's your condition, my recommendation is to get that right now. Would you pray and say, God, remove all the idols from my heart. And I want to put you back on the throne of my heart and love you supremely above all things and pursue you above all things in my life. That's my prayer. Friend, if you'll pray that, God will restore to you that joy, that fellowship, that satisfaction that really we can't describe. Father, bless your word to your people And we pray in the matchless name of Jesus.